Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 260. It's Monday, June 10th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's start right up with some climate news. This from Axios. Americans see climate change as health threat heading into summer. Two-thirds of Americans see climate change as a threat to human health, and most are bracing for a summer of extreme weather they expect will be as bad or worse than last year, according to the latest Axios Ipsos American Health Index. The big picture? There's a perception that the record heat, wildfires, floods, and other extreme weather events that played out vividly across screens last summer is a new baseline, though sentiment varies by age and political affiliation. 5% identified climate change as the top threat to public health, ranking ahead of COVID-19 and alcohol abuse, but far behind perennial fears like the drug crisis at 24%, obesity at 18%, and mental health at 16%. People are concerned about potential health effects of climate change, but it's not consistently top of mind. In day-to-day life, most don't see it as a large risk to their well-being, said Ipsos Vice President Mallory Newell. Just 12% said they or someone in their immediate family last summer personally experienced extreme weather effects, such as heat stroke, flooding, or asthma from wildfire smoke. 36% said they expected that extreme weather this summer will be similar to last year. About the same proportion think it will be worse. However, those expectations are perhaps not surprisingly shaded by partisanship. Democrats at 51% were far more likely than Republicans at 21% to say they expect this summer will be worse. Between the lines, the poll also found broad confidence in the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, suggesting the agency's missteps during the COVID-19 pandemic haven't tarnished its reputation. By about a 2-to-1 margin, people said the agency is concerned about the public's well-being and follows through on its mission to protect public health. Notably, 82% agree that parents should follow the CDC's recommended schedule for childhood immunizations. That's broad, strong agreement in a period when vaccines are highly politicized and can be a lightning rod for some parents, Newell said. And next up, more climate news. This from Stat News. Smoke exposure from California's wildfires linked to 52,000 deaths, early deaths in the state, study says. When large swaths of the East Coast were shrouded in wildfire smoke last summer, scientists in California grimly joked that maybe, finally, power brokers in New York and Washington, D.C. would be spurred to act on the burning issue that has long plagued the West Coast. Despite wildfire seasons that regularly burn hundreds of thousands of acres in California alone each year, researchers know relatively little about the long-term effects of chronic wildfire smoke on the body, and funding to reduce the known harms of exposure is scarce. In a paper published in Science Advances, researchers at UCLA School of Public Health tried to chip away at that knowledge gap. They estimated that somewhere between 52,000 and 56,000 people in California died prematurely between the years 2008 and 2018 due to chronic exposure to the dangerous particulate matter in wildfire smoke, and the economic impact of those deaths was at least $432 billion. Okay, to get a little bit better idea, that's an 11-year period, so that would be about 5,000 early deaths per year in California, and that $432 billion total cost of the 11 years would turn out to be about $1,000 per resident per year. So that's a pretty huge expense when you're talking about what you might want to put into prevention and mitigation. Yikes. And of course, these deaths are just those deaths that occurred in California, while the wildfire smoke does not respect state boundaries. Okay, next up, a story on food and water security. This from Medical Express. Secure access to food and water is decreasing for U.S. children, research finds. Between 2005 and 2020, the number of children facing simultaneous water and food insecurity in the United States more than doubled. Additionally, Black and Hispanic children were several times more likely than white children to experience food and water insecurity at the same time. In a study published in Nature Water, the researchers examined water insecurity, food insecurity, and their simultaneous occurrence among children in the United States. Water insecurity or food insecurity, the lack of consistent, safe access to food or water, can be devastating to healthy growth, according to researchers. Water insecurity has been linked to problems with mental health, physical health, nutrition, and economic well-being. Food insecurity has been associated with poor mental health, diabetes, poor nutrition, obesity, cardiovascular disease, and premature death. Around the world, food and water insecurity are often driven by poverty, inadequate access to resources, and climate-related issues. In high-income nations like the U.S., food and water insecurity can be triggered by a range of circumstances, including sudden income loss, familial instability, or infrastructure problems. Though much more common at lower income levels, the researchers said that water and food insecurity occur far more often than expected in the U.S. In 2005 and 2006, 4.6% of all children in the United States experienced both water and food insecurity. By the 2017 to 2020 survey cycle, the researchers found that the percentage of children nationwide who faced both problems rose to 10.3%, more than doubling. Water insecurity fluctuated between 2005 and 2013. Then the 2013 water crisis in Flint, Michigan made national news. Between 2013 and 2020, the odds of water insecurity, as measured by whether children avoided drinking their tap water, rose by 88%. Avoiding tap water is associated with other problems that can negatively affect food and water intake. People who avoid tap water are less likely to cook nutritious food for their children because they lack a trusted water source in the kitchen taps. People who avoid tap water also consume higher levels of sugary beverages. Additionally, they may also have less money for nutritious food because they are purchasing bottled water, which is far more expensive. Compared to the national average, the number among Hispanic children are much higher. The results showed that Black children were 3.5 times more likely than white children to experience simultaneous food and water insecurity. Hispanic children, meanwhile, were over 7 times more likely than white children to experience simultaneous food and water insecurity. Though availability of safe, reliable water access is a critical part of water security, trust of tap water is also a factor, both for children and their parents. The researchers said that when parents do not trust the water, they are less likely to give it to their children for fear it will make them sick. Most people are aware that Flint, Michigan experienced a crisis related to unsafe tap water, and Flint is a majority Black community. Since then, there have been other highly visible problems with water systems in minority communities like Newark in New Jersey and Jackson in Mississippi. When you see on the news that people who look like you are getting sick from tap water, it can amplify mistrust. Additionally, minoritized populations often have poor access to services, especially people who live in low-income communities. There are reports that people with brown water coming out of their tap were told it was safe to drink, but smell, taste, and color affect whether people trust their water. This mistrust is rational and needs to be addressed. The researchers said that worldwide water insecurity is expected to increase in the coming years due to pressure from climate change, population growth, and aging infrastructure. Though they said tap water avoidance data is useful, they believe that directly measuring water insecurity experiences is important. Right now, many people in the U.S. equate the existence of water infrastructure with being water secure, but piped water can be unaffordable, contaminated, dried up, or otherwise not available. And let us not forget that there are millions of people in the U.S. living without piped water. To rebuild trust in this system, we should provide testing to show that water is safe. We should replace lead service lines and provide filters where water is not safe. These actions will help ensure that our nation's children have access to the clean water they need to grow and thrive, and that their families do not suffer extra financial and mental stress because of uncertain water quality. Amen to that. Now let's move worldwide. It's a report from NPR. 1 in 4 young children suffer extreme food poverty. A new report from UNICEF has pulled together data from 137 low- and middle-income countries to understand what young children are being fed and what that means for their growth, as well as the state of child development around the world. And the results are alarming. 1 in 4 children under the age of 5 are experiencing what the study authors call, quote, severe food poverty, which means kids are only being fed 2 or less food groups per day. It amounts to 181 million children who are deprived of the diets they need to survive, said Harriet Torlice, a nutrition specialist at UNICEF and the lead author on the report. If you think about these diets, they really don't contain the range of vitamins and minerals and proteins that children need to grow and develop. Nutrition experts told NPR the numbers in the UNICEF report show the world is not making progress in tackling malnutrition and hunger. The COVID-19 pandemic, the war in Ukraine, inflation, and localized conflicts all added to food supply disruptions, as well as an increase in food prices. It's not only that kids aren't eating enough food, it's that they're eating the wrong foods. Experts say aggressive advertising of snacks and sugary beverages that often target children play a big role, and low-income countries have a harder time regulating those industries. One of the features of these snack foods is that they're often really cheap and they fill you up, and so people are inclined to buy them, says Deanna Olney, director of the Nutrition, Diets, and Health Unit at the International Food Policy Research Institute. But if they were more expensive because of taxes, you know, then maybe they'd be less inclined to choose those for their children, Olney says. The abundance of ultra-processed foods is also likely a contributor to increasing rates of overweight and obesity among children. Olney says that's an issue that needs more attention. In Gaza, extreme numbers underscore how conflict increases acute hunger for children. While conflict is not the biggest driver of child hunger across the globe, it does cause some of the worst cases, such as Sudan, Somalia, and Gaza. Experts say that since technological advances have made it possible to more accurately measure food intake in conflict zones, Gaza has experienced the highest rate of severe malnutrition ever documented. Severe child food poverty is driving high rates of wasting and stunted growth. The stakes are high for the large numbers of children living in severe food poverty, with far-reaching implications for overall global development. Malnutrition prevents children from reaching their full potential by not only stunting physical growth, but brain development as well. Even if they do make it to adulthood, their ability to fully contribute to their community and to have productivity of their country is limited compared to children who have had access to nutritious food. The good news? There are solutions. Several low-income countries such as Nepal and Burkina Faso have managed to cut the rate of severe child food poverty in half. Rwanda has done so by a third. Experts say they all have several common factors that have led to success. The first being that they've all made a real, deliberate effort to improve the supply of local nutritious foods, be it pulses or vegetables or poultry, says Harriet Torlice. The less a country is reliant on imports for food, nutrition experts say, the better their chances of minimizing hunger. Other countries are taking on the influx of ultra-processed foods. In Peru, for example, the government introduced legislation that processed foods and beverages must carry a warning label listing sugar, fat, and salt content, and they put a 25% tax on high sugar drinks. And we've seen in Nepal now, a nationwide cash grant to poor families has increased their purchases of nutritious foods such as meat and pulses, Torlice says. And then there's been a real effort within the health system to reach families with essential counseling and support so that caregivers know how to best feed their children using locally available nutritious foods. Still, there needs to be a better, broader approach to tackling child hunger. We are sending people to the moon, we are doing all kinds of technologically advanced stuff, and yet we are not able to feed children. It's really a shame. So for generations now, we live in a world that has had more than enough food for everyone. The problem is getting it to those who need it. A sad commentary on our human culture. Okay, well, next up, let's look at a status of girls in Ohio data summary. This comes from Ohio's the Center for Community Solutions. Supporting Ohio's girls during their formative years is not just something we should do, but it is something we must do in building a more equitable and healthier Ohio. Through understanding the experiences of girls in Ohio, we can create programs and policies that uplift, promote, and support the well-being and health of Ohio's girls, who will become women with a strong foundation for success. There are 1.3 million girls living in Ohio. That's 228,000 of those, or 17.5%, live in poverty. So let's just go over a couple of these categories. First, mental health. 56% of high school girls felt hopeless every day for 2 weeks at some point in the past 12 months, and 32% seriously considered suicide. 8 in 10 Ohio high school girls get less than 8 hours of sleep on a school night. 28% of Ohio school girls and 40% of middle school girls reported being electronically bullied during the past 12 months. Now, the category of eating and exercise, 80% of Ohio middle school girls and 86% of high school girls had not eaten breakfast at all in the last 7 days. 17% of Ohio high school girls and 19% of middle school girls were not physically active for 60 minutes on any day in the last 7 days. 16% of youth age 10 to 17 were obese from 2019 to 2022. And on sexual health, 40% of Ohio high schools taught students all 22 critical sexual health education topics in a required course, along with 11% of Ohio middle schools. So if those don't overlap, that means you basically have at least half of public school students or Ohio students not getting all of critical sexual health education topics taught. 21% of Ohio girls had experienced sexual violence in the last 12 months, compared to 18% nationwide. Teen pregnancy, one of the places where we got at least some good news. 34% decrease in teen births in girls aged 15 to 19 years old in recent years. 87 of 88 Ohio counties have seen pregnancy rates decrease. 60% of Ohio high school girls who are sexually active did not use birth controls, IUD, or implant, a shot, patch, or birth control ring before last sexual intercourse. 9% use no methods of contraception. So I take it from this that the standard is having a birth control that works over time that you don't have to use at the time of the sexual encounter. And while only 60% of them did not meet that standard, 91% did use some form of contraception at the sexual encounter. And on a category of risk-taking, 40% of high school girls have tried vaping products. 28% of girls have had at least one drink of alcohol in the past 30 days, and that compares to 18% of boys. And in conclusion, interventions focused on the needs of girls are critical, as mental health present differently between, as mental illness and health present differently between the sexes. Girls have unique struggles with their mental health, social media, body image, bullying, and sexual violence. Certainly, Ohio, we can do better. And moving to maternal health care, this from Medical Express. Many U.S. women unhappy with maternal health care poll finds. Many women are unhappy with the state of U.S. maternal health care, but a major new poll finds most Americans don't understand how badly the nation lags behind other wealthy countries in this area. Only about 2 in 5, or 42% of women currently pregnant or ever pregnant, strongly felt they had access to the best possible medical care while pregnant, down significantly from 50% in 2022, according to the Harris Poll's second annual survey on the state of maternal health care. Women reported similar numbers regarding their health care while giving birth. About 44% felt they had access to the best possible medical care during delivery, down from 52% in 2022. These results confirm that pregnancy and birth care in the United States is on the decline, and there is much room for improvement, said Christina Lojek, research manager, media and communications researcher at the Harris Poll. Despite this, Americans are still likely to rank U.S. maternal care better than it actually is when compared to that of other high-income countries. For example, only about 1 in 4, or 29% of Americans surveyed, correctly stated that the United States does not have one of the lowest rates of infant mortality among developed countries. In fact, the United States has the highest rate of infant mortality among wealthy nations, at 5.4 deaths for every 1,000 live births. Similarly, only about 2 in 5, 40% of Americans knew that the country has one of the highest rates of maternal mortality. Maternal mortality rates in the United States are double and sometimes triple that of other wealthy nations, according to a Commonwealth report issued earlier this week. But only half of all Americans, 50%, and just 57% of Black Americans know that Black women are nearly three times as likely as white women to die from pregnancy-related causes, the poll found. Overall, Americans are poorly informed about giving birth in the U.S., specifically surrounding risks and complications, especially for black women. The poll also found that many U.S. women develop health problems during pregnancy, for which they need good care. Nearly 3 in 5, or 57% of women who are or have been pregnant, said they were diagnosed with a medical condition between conception and after delivery. That includes about 1 in 3, 32%, who said they were diagnosed with anxiety, depression, or another mental health condition. About 1 in 5, or 21%, of women who sought help for their mental health problems said they either did not receive care or were unhappy with the care they got. Overall, the poll found that the United States has a poor track record when it comes to giving pregnant women the health care and support they need. Okay, next up, a story that the aftermath of COVID-19 lives on. This from Stat News. Concern is real about long COVID's impact on Americans and disability claims, report says. The COVID pandemic has been called a mass disabling event since early on, the kind of once-in-a-generation public health crisis that could shape millions of people's lives forever. But while more people self-identified as disabled since the pandemic began, applications for disability benefits have stayed level, according to data from the Social Security Administration. That could change as the burden of long COVID becomes clearer. A new report commissioned by the Social Security Administration in 2022 captures what we know so far about long COVID and hints at how the nation's disability benefit system might need to shift in the wake of the pandemic. Over 15 million people in the United States receive benefits through Social Security disability insurance and supplemental security income. Concern is real that long COVID may result in an increase in applications for disability, the report says. As of April, 5.3% of U.S. adults, or 13.7 million people, had long COVID, according to survey data from the CDC. Studies suggest women are nearly twice as likely as men to experience long COVID. However, long COVID is difficult to map onto the agency's existing eligibility requirements for disability insurance, says Stephanie Renane, an economist at the RAND Corporation who studied disability benefits. The severity and duration of the condition can vary a lot, and in ways that we can't fully predict yet. Even after 4 years, the research landscape in this area is evolving quickly, and summary reports like this are helpful to translate the state of knowledge into something actionable for policymakers. A group of experts from across medical disciplines met 7 times under the direction of the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine to distill the scientific literature. The outcome is a 200-plus page document outlining long COVID's wide reach, both in the population and in individual people's bodies, taking a toll on various organ systems. The Social Security Administration has not yet said what it will do with the report's conclusions. The agency is in process of updating its long COVID guidance. However, disability listings might not capture long COVID. Long COVID's chameleonic nature poses a challenge to the Social Security Administration, which determines whether people are so disabled by their condition that they can't work. The agency has a listing of conditions and impairments that are considered severe enough to interrupt someone's working life. Long COVID isn't on the list. Neither are conditions like chronic fatigue syndrome or fibromyalgia. That means most individuals with long COVID applying for Social Security disability benefits will do so on the basis of health effects not covered in the listings. And while the administration has issued guidance to its adjudicators on how to field long COVID applications, it does not provide sufficient guidance for assessing functional status or weighing severity, the report says. To receive disability benefits, a person has to meet the statutory definition of disability, which for adults means they have a serious and medically determinable physical or mental disability that keeps them from participating in the labor force and earning income for at least a year. Children are considered disabled if they have severe functional limitations due to severe physical or mental disability. Proving disability status to gain benefits can be a long and arduous process. If someone's disability doesn't match the list of pre-approved impairments, the agency then determines whether it thinks the applicant could hold any job based on their documented level of function, or for children, whether they could generally participate in their lives. The ambiguity in diagnosis and variation in symptoms, severity, and duration of long COVID and limited knowledge base make it difficult to include long COVID as a listed impairment for Social Security Administration at this time, said Rename, the economist. But hopefully this report will give some guidance as to indicators to watch for, which may help determine when the impacts and duration could be severe enough to meet the Social Security Administration's eligibility standards for disability insurance. long-haul COVID and long-haul disability applications. And, of course, medical debt is the number one cause for bankruptcy in this country. That's been true for many years. This next story gets at medical debt. This from Stat News. When medical debt relief is not enough, a study showing what doesn't work may help point to better solutions. The amount of medical debt in the U.S. is estimated to exceed $220 billion and affects 2 in 5 adults. Medical debt most often results from unexpected injuries and illnesses and disproportionately affects people of color, low-income households, women, and parents. With medical debt comes poor financial and health outcomes and psychological duress. Although people who don't have health insurance are at the highest risk for incurring medical debt, most people with such debt do have insurance, a byproduct of high and rising provider prices and the cost-sharing burden they create for those with insurance. Hospitals often sell outstanding debt to collection agencies, and medical debt relief works by using donations to negotiate the purchase of large amounts of debt from these agencies at a fraction of the face value. A team of researchers assessed the impact of medical debt relief using a rigorous randomized design that allowed them to compare people who had medical debt relieved and those who did not. Contrary to expectations, they found that relieving medical debt did not improve financial outcomes such as access to credit, healthcare utilization, or financial distress, and actually reduced the likelihood of repaying existing medical bills. Debt relief was even found to have a small but significant negative effect on the mental health of certain subpopulations in the study. But just as new research suggests that medical crowdsourcing is too far from the source of the problem to create real change, medical debt relief may also be an excessively downstream strategy. The fact that debt can be purchased for pennies on the dollar is part of the appeal of debt relief, allowing donors to feel like their donations are going further. But here lies a clue as to why debt relief did not have the hoped-for effect. As the authors of the working paper foreshadow in their introduction, this feature may be a bug. Although proponents of medical debt relief tout the low cost as a feature, the price reflects low recovery rates, which suggests the financial impacts on households may be a small fraction of the face value of debt relieved. In other words, a lot of medical debt never gets paid anyways. This is a good way of understanding the results and why they differ from studies of other types of debt, such as student loans, where recovery rates are higher, and research has shown that relieving such debt meaningfully affects financial outcomes. Medical debt, by comparison, may be so overwhelming that the prospect of payment is not realistic, especially among the lowest income households. For people who have many other debts, paying off some of their medical debt may not have a transformational effect. The authors speculate that the negative impact on the mental health of some participants they observed may reflect the fact that the debt relief has heightened awareness of, quote, the gap between resources and needs. In short, for some, the intervention of medical debt relief may be both too little and too late. While these results provide discouraging news about debt relief as a solution to the problem caused by medical debt, the hardship caused by debt are all too real. People with medical debt often incur other debts as a consequence, resulting in spiraling financial instability. Medical debt can lead to unconscionable choices between paying bills and paying for other necessities, including getting needed medical care. Falling disproportionately on people of color, medical debt both reflects and worsens existing inequities. There are a number of efforts that aim to prevent medical debt in the first place by intervening further upstream. Some state and local governments are working on policies that restrict aggressive debt collection. Some initiatives increase requirements on hospitals to standardize financial assistance policies and ensure that no one who is eligible for aid is billed for care. Other efforts include capping interest rates and strengthening consumer protections. The federal government has taken steps to remove medical debt from credit reporting and is exploring how to protect consumers with debts who may be offered medical credit cards and provider loans. Needless to say, larger reforms such as Medicaid expansion in states without it and policies that reduce provider prices would go even further to prevent unmanageable financial burdens on patients. The organization Undo Medical Debt notes that to prevent new debts, we need to fix the broken healthcare system itself. Ain't that the truth? For so many years, medical debt has been the leading cause of bankruptcy and much lesser burdens than actual bankruptcy, much stress, financial and psychological, on folks. Would be a good time to have a national health program with everyone in and nobody out and have a system that does not have excessive co-pays or deductibles.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. My personal guarantee to you is that if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And should that not be the case, I will gladly refund you triple your money. Okay, well, next up, I have a very interesting article. Of course, public health and epidemiology is a lot about trying to determine what health problems are and what the determinants are. And this article gets at one that's relatively new that probably should be added to the mix. This is from Medical Express. Excluding partisanship questions from health surveys could lead to ineffective policy, says researchers. A new commentary in the American Journal of Public Health urges public health researchers to incorporate questions about partisan identity in demographic data collection, arguing that excluding this information could lead to ineffective policy and health promotion interventions. The partisan divide in attitudes towards vaccination and masking during the COVID-19 pandemic made clear that the ever-rising polarization in America extends far beyond electoral politics, with stark consequences for health. Despite these consequences, which include partisan differences in a range of health behaviors and health outcomes, none of the publicly available surveys conducted by federal agencies or other nationwide assessments measure partisanship. Excluding partisan questions in health surveys is detrimental to health, and public health researchers in the U.S. should indeed inquire about political party identification when collecting demographic data. By including partisanship in more public health surveys, we'll be able to better track how partisanship is impacting individual health attitudes and behaviors. In doing so, we'll be better able to monitor the political determinants of health and to develop successful interventions to improve public health that appropriately account for how partisanship is shaping individual behavior. For example, neglecting to gather data on partisan identity may prevent health providers from developing tailored communication or treatment plans for their patients, and it could also prevent health advocates and officials from crafting effective public health messaging that bridges political divides and resonates with the broader public. Unfortunately, it's difficult to meet people where they are if we don't know where they are. Measuring partisan identity in public opinion surveys allows us to figure out why some people are more likely than others to reject evidence-based health behavior and develop effective health promotion strategies. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up, switching gears a bit, this from Medical Express. Only half of individuals disclose or believe they should reveal having a sexually transmitted infection prior to sexual intercourse. A review of research to date reveals the complex nature of revealing a diagnosis of a sexually transmitted infection to a partner ahead of engaging in sexual activity. With individuals experiencing a variety of feelings and emotions related to the prospect of disclosure, the research shows that only around half or fewer individuals felt able to disclose their diagnosis to a partner before sexual engagement. The results, published in the Journal of Sex Research, also show a similar number of people believe they should have to disclose having a sexually transmitted infection to a partner prior to engaging in sexual intercourse. Around 1 in 5 people in the U.S. have a sexually transmitted infection at any one time, with more than 26,000 million incidents reported to health services. Chlamydia, gonorrhea, and syphilis have been at record levels for several years and continue to rise, according to official data. So be careful out there, my friends. Communicate for the sake of yourself and each other. And in the latest twist on our drug epidemic in the U.S., this from The Hill, Midwest health departments warn of new deadly animal tranquilizers emergence. Health departments in the Midwest are warning of the emergence of a new deadly animal tranquilizer that's linked to overdose deaths. The drug, metamidine, is a powerful sedative used in veterinary medicine to keep dogs sedated and comfortable during exams and medical procedures. The U.S. FDA said when it approved the drug in 2022. The Detroit Free Press reported that the drug is most often cut into fentanyl, which is then cut into what passes as heroin. This drug, however, can't be reversed by naloxone or Narcan, which has been used to reverse overdoses for other drugs. So this is another one in a set of drugs that have a lot of mimicking effects of other drugs, but particularly since you can't reverse it with naloxone or Narcan, it's causing a lot of problems in overdose prevention. And moving to semi-legal drugs, this from MedPage Today, Juul Vaping Products' stay of execution is now more official. In yet another delay in FDA action to regulate electronic cigarettes, the agency announced it was rescinding its earlier denial of the marketing orders necessary for Juul to keep its vaping products on retail shelves. The FDA had effectively ordered Juul off the market in June 2022, determining that the company's pre-market tobacco product applications didn't show enough evidence that public health would be protected if the e-cigarettes and nicotine pods remained for sale. Then in July 2022, the agency instituted an administrative stay that kept the marketing order denial from taking effect, citing a need for additional review of certain scientific issues. Now the FDA has officially taken denial off the table and put Juul's products back into an under-review status, during which they will all be allowed to remain for sale. Last year, the Supreme Court declined to hear arguments from Avail Vapor, challenging FDA's authority to deny approval of flavored e-cigarette products. However, in January, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit ruled against FDA for rejecting market applications by Triton Distribution for its non-tobacco flavored open system e-liquid products, and a Supreme Court case is again possible. The FDA said that rescinding Juul's marketing denial order didn't mean that the company's products are now authorized, nor does it indicate whether the applications are likely to be authorized or denied. Rather, it returns the applications to pending status under substantive review by the FDA. The American Lung Association said in a statement to CNN that it was deeply troubled by the latest action by FDA and urged the agency to issue marketing denial orders for all Juul products. Juul is largely responsible for the youth e-cigarette epidemic from 2017 to 2019, said Erica Sward, the association's assistant vice president of nationwide advocacy. These products and its manufacturer clearly do not meet the standard for protecting the public health. FDA must follow the law and not permit any Juul product or other tobacco product to be sold in the U.S. prior to receiving a pre-market authorization. So, are e-cigarettes regulated or not? Yes, we don't really know. Okay, well, last up in regular reporting, do a little bit of update on the bird flu epidemic. This from Reuters, an exclusive from them. Cows infected with bird flu have died in five U.S. states. Dairy cows infected from avian flu in five U.S. states have died or been slaughtered by farmers because they did not recover, state officials and academics told Reuters. Reports of the deaths suggest the bird flu outbreak in cows could take a greater economic toll in the farm belt than initially thought. Farmers have long culled poultry infected by the virus, but cows cost much more to raise than chickens or turkeys. Avian flu has infected dairy cows in more than 80 herds across 10 states since late March, according to the USDA. Some of the animals died of secondary infections contracted after bird flu weakened their immune systems, said state veterinarians, agriculture officials, and academics assisting in state responses to bird flu. Other cows were killed by farmers because they failed to recover from the virus. In South Dakota, a 1,700-cow dairy sent a dozen of their animals to slaughter after they did not recover from the virus and killed another dozen that contracted secondary infections, said Russ Daly, a professor with South Dakota State University and a veterinarian for the state extension office. You get sick cows from one disease, then this creates a domino effect for other things, like routine pneumonia and digestive issues, Daly said. A farm in Michigan killed about 10% of its 200 infected cows after they, too, failed to recover from the virus, said Phil Durst, an educator with Michigan State University Extension. In Colorado, some dairies reported culling cows with avian flu because they did not return to milk production, said Olga Roback, spokesperson for the State Department of Agriculture. Ohio Department of Agriculture spokesperson Megan Harshberger said infected cows have died in Ohio and other affected states, mostly due to secondary infections. So the key here is bird flu has been a huge economic problem for chickens and turkeys, killing millions and millions and millions of birds. But it was first thought that cows weren't as much, they're much more mildly infected. It just was thought to just temporarily reduce milk production, then they could get back to producing milk. But that it seems to be more serious than that, which of course is perhaps is going to lead to some of the reticence of dairy farmers of being identified as a herd that is infected. And hopefully that won't impede public health efforts. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature of the show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 21 bonus articles this week. First up, how tobacco companies use chemistry to get around menthol bans. Regulating chemicals one by one has allowed the tobacco industry to skirt menthol bans by creating new additives with similar effects but unclear safety profiles. Just another way to skirt regulation. This is something that chemical companies have been doing for a lot of consumer products and industrial products for decades. And usually it's tobacco companies leading nefarious ways, but they're picking up what a lot of chemical manufacturing companies have done in the past. That's why we probably need to regulate entire classes of chemicals. And in this case, like additives that have to do with flavorings that that affect smoking rates. Bonus article 2, ban fossil fuel ads says climate to save climate, says UN chief. So this is also kind of following the tobacco and now the fossil fuel industry, where they're in the plastics industry, add them in there too, which of course is related to fossil fuels, that they're using ads to basically greenwash their products and provide disinformation to try to soften the climate actions that people are demanding. Bonus Article 3, lawsuits targeting plastic pollution pile up as frustrated citizens and states seek accountability over greenwashing and misleading claims about recycling. So that's one of the more disillusioning things that has happened in recent years as we, you know, started recycling decades ago. And it turns out that only about 5% of recyclable plastics are actually ever recycled. It's kind of a bust. Bonus Article 4, your plastic-free kitchen, first steps in getting PFAS forever chemicals out of your diet. This is a good one on an individual or family basis to be able to try to limit your exposure to these dangerous chemicals. A lot of good suggestions there. Of course, eating out is particularly dangerous, particularly fast food. Is a way to get extra exposure. You'd think that cooking at home would be a lot better, but you got to be careful, particularly the storing and heating up foods in plastics. The one thing I think they missed here is that if your dishwasher, you're using those little pods, that is plastic that gets dissolved. And if it isn't properly rinsed, you can have a residue on your food. And even then, if it all goes down the drain, it ends up in the environment, in our water, and gets circulated around to everybody. So share the plastic. Use pods for washing dishes or washing your clothes. Yikes. Bonus Article 5, drugs, microplastics, and forever chemicals. New, unregulated contaminants emerge in the Great Lakes that traditional water treatment can't deal with. Yes. Well, this is actually talking about the Canadian side of the Great Lakes, but it's a problem that's dealt throughout the world. But since we have so much of the fresh water in the world and in the portion in the U.S., it's particularly important for us Great Lakes folks. But traditional water treatment is really being overrun because it can't get rid of the drugs and microplastics and forever chemicals with the traditional treatments that are used. Bonus Article 6, a bottled water company in Michigan is still extracting millions of gallons of water for free. So they can take all the water they want for free, but what do we get back? A bunch of microplastics. Bonus Article 7, as nuclear power flails in the U.S., White House bets on a big revival. Yikes, this is really bad, I think. And this is largely, this story is centered around a huge nuclear plant, one of the most recent plant in a long time, and a huge plant in Georgia, but just its cost overruns itself was $20 billion. This is to serve 1 million households with electricity. That would be the equivalent of $20,000 per household for just the cost overruns. Why don't we try solar? And of course, while nuclear power is often touted as being low on environmental damage, it's not that simple. And if you want to get a sense about how we deal with such problems, the next two articles will get at it. Bonus Article 8, program to pay nuclear fallout victims expires due to U.S. House inaction. So they're actually looking at extending and expanding the benefit of the so-called downwinders from the nuclear testing that happened years ago and is still, the fallout is literally causing cancer and stuff in people decades later. And in a similar story, Bonus Article 9, battling bureaucracy after burn pits. Why are civilian contractors left behind? So in the last couple years, the VA made it a lot easier to have claims related to exposure to burn pits. But now there's a civilian contractor for every soldier in the military, and they're not included. Why are they left behind? Again, battling bureaucracy. It would be nice if we just had a universal health program where if people had a health problem, it was treated. No regards to where that health problem came from. Bonus Article 10, properly fitting face masks can help block particulate pollution. So this was an interesting study that even just a surgical mask, the proper fitting is a big part of it, but even a surgical mask properly fitted can block huge amounts of particulate pollution. So if that's an issue when the fires peak up this summer, that's one way to deal with it if you want to try to get outside. Bonus Article 11, a new discovery that carbon dioxide increases airborne virus survival ups the ante for improved ventilation and for increased global CO2 levels. Might want to try to keep that down. But yeah, so in other words, if your home's closed up, or you know, you're even just in your bedroom all night breathing air and it's not getting air circulation, you build up carbon dioxide and increases the survival of airborne viruses. Bonus Article 12. Bird flu isn't a human pandemic yet. American contrariness could turn it into one. So the most interesting example of this, of course, is the fact that people are being warned not to eat, drink unpasteurized milk. And of course, unpasteurized milk use goes up. And then, of course, this kind of stubbornness that people have as far as not wanting to, cooperate with public health authorities and trying to track and mitigate, you know, a potential huge human pandemic could be, a side effect and a determinant of health. American contrariness, what do you know? Bonus Article 13, out of control. The discovery of H5N1 bird flu in mice is so alarming because it brings the virus closer to human homes. So this is over 50 mammals that have been identified with the bird flu virus in them, but mice is particularly one, because if you get the bird flu on a farm and you want to try to contain it, mice is a perfect way to move from a farm to a home, etc. And mice are pretty much universal. So it could be, you know, a source, an ongoing source, reservoir of the virus. Bonus Article 14. These are the bird flu questions that influenza and animal scientists desperately want answers to. So if you're interested in just a good overview of where we're at with the bird flu, that's a good article. Bonus Article 15. Following Florida's lead, New York wants a taste of Canada's medicine by creating a program to import drugs in bulk from Canada, which of course are a lot cheaper in Canada. This is a good example of the strange bedfellows politically made by our perverse healthcare system. When Florida and New York align up politically, that tells you something's interesting going on. And of course, the U.S. is basically the profit center for pretty much all the drug. We consume half of the pharmaceuticals, the legal pharmaceuticals, and over half of the illegal pharmaceuticals in the world. So we're huge drug consumers. And since we don't really control prices well, most of the rest of the world pays a fraction or a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what the U.S. pays for drugs. So this reimportation from Canada is not really novel, but it's being tried again and again. And since they got waivers for Florida, New York would like to do the same. Bonus Article 16. FDA panel votes against the psychedelic MDMA for PTSD. There's your numbers of the day, letters of the day. MDMA, of course, often previously known by the street name ecstasy, is a psychedelic that has shown some promise initially for PTSD, but there's a lot of questions that the FDA panel had, and they voted against it almost unanimously. There was one person who thought there was a low level of evidence and thought maybe letting it through the approval process. Bonus Article 17, health worker for a nonprofit. The new ban on non-compete contracts may not apply to you. This is just another weird regulatory thing. So the non-compete contracts really keep healthcare workers, basically the transition from jobs or setting up a new practice or whatever. It's not very good for competition when you have a non-compete contract. There's a lot of problems. Well, the thing is, the way the law is written is that generally doesn't apply to nonprofit hospitals, for instance, which are the majority of hospitals. So we'll see how much different that makes. And probably the gap between profits and nonprofits might create some political energy to change that. Bonus Article 18. Study indicates fewer than 1 in 4 patients receive dietary counseling after a heart attack. So, of course, diet is one of the most profound effects on our health, including heart disease, maybe even particularly heart disease, but only 1 in 4 patients receive any dietary counseling after a heart attack. And almost all of those 1 in 4 patients are people that are in cardiac rehab. Bonus Article 19, should blood pressure guidelines be different for women and men? Women seem to respond meaning getting more strokes or heart attacks at lower blood pressures than men, partly just because even adjusting for size, women tend to have smaller blood vessels and stuff, so could be more susceptible to the ravages of high blood pressure or other heart disease. In an interesting article, Bonus 20, Associated Press style book embraces respectful language on obesity. So this is one where saying that a person who has obesity rather than an obese person is you're separating the person from the disease is very important. And it's good to see that journalists are picking up on that. Last but not least, Bonus Article 21, a good read and a think piece. Human culture is changing too fast for evolution to catch up. Here's how it may affect you. So this is really, you know, as modern culture has accelerated in so many ways, we're seeing increasing mismatches between basically how our brains work and how we adapt to our environment. When there's a mismatch between the historical tens of thousands and even millions of years of existence of human beings, and now all of a sudden are faced with hugely different environments, we're having a hard time of actually adapting to that. So, a good read on how that might affect you and us as a whole. You can read all of these articles and all the articles I've reported on in previous episodes by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.